This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is exactly 5:05 in the evening, and for our first story, some updates on cash aid. Finance Minister Lim Guan Eng announced today that the Pakatan Harapan government will distribute the 300 ringgit Bantuan Sara Hidup Direct cash aid to B40 households beginning January 28th.
Bayaran bagi program Bantuan Sara Hidup BSH 2019 fasa pertama akan dilaksanakan mulai 28 Januari tahun hadapan mengikut pangkalan data lama terus ke dalam akaun bank penerima. Menteri Kewangan Lim Guan Eng melalui satu kenyataan memaklumkan untuk fasa pertama ini kerajaan masih menggunakan pengkalan data yang lama yang berkemungkinan mengandungi nama penerima yang tidak layak bagi membolehkan bayaran dibuat secepat mungkin sebelum Februari depan.
In the initial phase, payments will include those pre-qualified under the discontinued One Malaysia People's Aid or BRIM from the previous BN administration. Guan Eng said that this temporary compromise was made to ensure payments could be made according to the prescribed schedule and also enables those who would not strictly qualify under the BSH scheme to enjoy the direct cash aid.
So in a statement, he said the government had to use the old database, which most likely contained ineligible beneficiaries, to allow payments to be made immediately before February 2019. The cleanup process to remove names of ineligible beneficiaries as they are not from that B40 group will require a long time to be carried out.
The BSH is expected to benefit about 4.1 million households next year, involving an allocation of 1.2 billion ringgit, with payments being credited directly into the recipient's bank accounts. Once the database is updated, the remaining BSH payments would adopt the new mechanism announced in the 2019 budget. For a refresher, here is a snippet of Lim Guan Eng during the budget 2019, talking through some of the criteria for the new Bantuan Sara Hidup.
Pertama, kerajaan akan meneruskan dan menambah baik bantuan sara hidup dengan memberikan bantuan secara lebih bersasar dan bergantung kepada saiz isi rumah. Mulai Januari 2019, isi rumah berpendapatan bulanan RM2,000 dan ke bawah akan menerima bantuan berjumlah RM1,000. Isi rumah berpendapatan bulanan dari RM2,001 hingga RM3,000 akan menerima bantuan berjumlah RM750. Dan isi rumah berpendapatan bulanan dari RM3,001 hingga RM4,000 akan menerima bantuan sebanyak RM500. Selain itu, kerajaan akan memperkenalkan kadar tambahan bantuan sara hidup sebanyak RM120 untuk setiap anak berumur 18 tahun ke bawah terhad kepada 4 orang. Kecuali anak OKU yang tidak dihadkan umur mereka. Sebagai contoh, sekiranya isi rumah berpendapatan bulanan RM2,000 ke bawah dan mempunyai 4 orang anak, maka jumlah bantuan sara hidup yang akan diterima adalah sebanyak RM1,480, iaitu lebih banyak daripada jumlah BRIM sedia ada sebanyak RM1,200. Oleh itu, dianggarkan sebanyak 4.1 juta isi rumah akan terus menerima bantuan kewangan daripada kerajaan dengan peruntukan RM5 bilion.
So that was Finance Minister Lim Guan Eng during his maiden budget, I suppose, budget 2019, talking about how the new Bantuan Sara Hidup is going to work. Of course, the update today is that essentially, they're going to be distributing that 300 ringgit direct cash aid to B40 households. They're going to be following the previous list of names, basically, that were available while they work through that process of cleaning it up.
So I think today, Khairi Jamaluddin, the shadow finance minister, of course, criticised Guan Eng's move, saying that, oh, didn't you call this political bribery and did that last time? Why are you doing the same system? But I think the difference is that, or rather, what's sort of changed or rather not changed is that the system they use cannot be updated in time. And I think in the meantime, while they do that, the ones who are on the end of those, the ones who are receiving the aid, the ones in the B40 group will want that money desperately, because I think a lot of them also budget, put it into their yearly budget. And if they don't have it, then it's kind of tough on them, especially with rising living costs.
I agree. I do think that it is something that people and families have been building into their annual budgets. And it is something that is going to be pretty difficult to go without And to miss out on it just because of a bureaucratic mix-up, yeah, fundamentally, just to say, sorry, we don't have the list of names in time. I think this is a reasonable compromise, but you can let us know what you think. What do you think about this? What do you think about the Bantuan Sara Hidup in general? You can WhatsApp us and let us know, 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. Moving on, though, to our next story about a Christmas gift that our neighbour has just received.
Thailand's parliament gave the country's citizens what one lawmaker called a New Year's gift of medical marijuana. On Tuesday, that country's lawmakers voted to change an existing law to allow pot for medicinal and research purposes. The new rules will also allow kratom, which is a plant native to the region that's used to treat pain, anxiety, and other issues. But the country still hasn't approved it for recreational use.
This makes Thailand the first country in Southeast Asia to allow the use of medical marijuana. The same law also, as she said, applies to kratom or ketom.
Thank you for saying kratom. She went kratom.
Kratom. marijuana was first used in Thailand as a traditional medicine until it was banned in the 1930s. As we know, the region is notorious for its hardline approach to drugs and strict penalties for drug-related crimes.
So similar to how it's going to be or how it has been in other countries, consumers will be able to carry specified amounts necessary for medicinal purposes if they have a prescription or a recognized certificate. Licenses for production and sale of the product are also going to be strictly controlled. Now, and as we know and as we've heard across the world, countries have been revisiting those marijuana laws. The British government approved medical marijuana earlier this year. It became available on November 1st from the NHS to patients with a prescription. Medications derived from cannabis became legal in Germany last year. And it's also legal in Australia and Ireland. All this, of course, medical marijuana. In the United States, it's legal in 30 states, though the laws governing what's permitted do vary from state to state.
Our region, of course, in Southeast Asia remains pretty strict overall. Earlier this year, you may remember the case of a man in Malaysia here who was given the death sentence for selling cannabis oil. Meanwhile, in Bali, a British man is facing up to 15 years in prison after being found with cannabis oil, which he says he needed for medical reasons. And on that note, what are those medical reasons? Dr. Maya Nagaratnam, a pain management and anesthetic consultant, talks about the different components in marijuana and what medical benefits they bring.
There are two main substances that has come under scrutiny. That one is cannabinoid, which is CBD, and the other is 9-tetrahydrocannabinoid, which we'll call THC. There is good research to show that actually it has a lot of medical benefits. CBD can cause medical positive effects, whereas the THC is the one that is the culprit in creating the high that you get when you smoke pot. For some reason, you can't get pure forms of CBD. They always come in a mixture. And we find that the medical uses are positive when the CBD ratio is higher than the THC ratio. Some of the key areas in which the medical community look at cannabinoids is for treatment in neuropathic type pain. These are pain due to nerves, multiple sclerosis, where you get severe muscle spasms. And they have shown successful use in these niche areas. Also quite useful is in cancer treatment. As we know, a lot of cancer treatment is associated with nausea and vomiting, refractory nausea and vomiting, which is not amenable to the usual medications that we have. And in epilepsy, it can cause a reduction in the nerve stimulation so that it lowers the threshold for triggers of epilepsy.
That was Dr. Maya Nagaratnam, pain management and anesthetic consultant, talking about basically medical marijuana and its benefits. So I suppose Thailand is the first in the region, and it's a big one because, like we said, the region is very strict. We're the ones who still have death penalties. We're the ones who still continue to have incredibly long jail sentences just for the possession of marijuana, for instance. And even as we heard earlier in examples, when it is something that is in people's possession for medical purposes. And I'm kind of glad to see Thailand take charge of it. I'm kind of glad to see them start. I wonder whether it's going to create a follow-through effect where other countries are going to want to do the same. And I think that there is something there, because obviously it is a very lucrative industry. And if you regulate it, and it seems as if everybody worldwide is regulating it quite strictly, then if nothing else, the government stands to make money off it as well.
I think so. I think we are trying to play catch up, because I think in October, Nurul Issa said she's working on a bill, or rather she's drafting up a proposal to legalize medical marijuana here. And some of the other cabinet ministers have said that they are keen on doing so as well.
Was it legalizing or decriminalizing?
Ooh.
Yeah, because I remember when we spoke to her, she drew a pretty strong distinction between the two. And I do think that that is one of those things that we need to address and talk about, because countries are legalizing it, right? They're turning it into a strictly regulated industry.
Doctors prescribe it, and yes, doctors can monitor how you use it and stuff like that.
Exactly. And you can also monitor abuse, whereas decriminalizing it would be something really quite different. So, I do agree that we're just playing catch up. I want to see how far we can take it, though. I do think that there is enough science to back up the facts that they help people with chronic pain conditions. And if for that reason alone, it seems like a good idea to me. But let us know. WhatsApp us. Let us know if you would like to see medical marijuana legalized or decriminalized here. WhatsApp 018-789-8899 to talk to us. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we're going to be talking about celebrity CEOs. So keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Become fabulous millionaires. BFM 89.9.
It's the Evening Edition with Lynn and Kelvin, and we are taking you through some of our favorite headlines from the day. Our next story is about celebrity CEOs.
In the last seven deals that I've been involved with, there were 2.5 million stockholders who have made a pre-tax profit of $12 billion. Thank you. I am not a destroyer of companies. I am a liberator of them.
Wow.
So that came, of course, from Wall Street, greed is good, all of that. And from Elon Musk to Sheryl Sandberg, we're now seeing charismatic corporate leaders becoming global cultural icons. They capture the zeitgeist with edifying TED Talks, best-selling autobiographies, and social media presences that rival those of rock stars.
For many executives, cultural celebrity is good branding and an inoculant to merciless P&Ls or disapproving boards of directors. A shrewd CEO can use Twitter to counter rumors on Wall Street or dodge a public relations nightmare.
But recent disruptions in the tech industry suggest that celebrity may have its limits. Global fame is not foolproof when government investigators come knocking.
In fact, corporate celebs may find their renown even more fleeting than other high achievers due to the stakes and scale. Leading a billion-dollar international conglomerate through a volatile period comes with responsibilities that far outstrip those of authors and or actors.
In fact, the ranks of global celebrities are populated with sports stars and entertainers. Here and there, you see a public servant capturing icon status, think Barack Obama or U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Celebrity scientists such as Stephen Hawking and writers such as J.K. Rowling and Stephen King are, however, few and far between.
In the business world, there have always been enigmatic corporate leaders, but only a handful. Henry Ford, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Martha Stewart, they've become cultural icons. The recent swell of business leaders who have been transformed into celebrities can be traced to a number of factors.
So first, many sports figures have been brought low by scandal, and professional sports as a whole have become associated with greed. Secondly, public trust in CEOs has risen as it has fallen in political leaders. CEOs have also been empowered to change lanes. Ambitious executives can branch out into everything from TV to politics to sports. And the cult of the savvy, no-nonsense business leader thrives in popular reality shows such as Shark Tank.
Finally, social media has become omnipresent, and gossip, personal problems, and internal tensions have turned the business news into high drama. Here, Wired's editor-in-chief, Nick Thompson, explains Elon Musk's Twitter presence and how it can mess with his company.
Musk has a very complicated relationship with the internet. He has a very difficult situation with his companies, and he's also a genius. So you combine those three things, and you've got a real mess. The particular thing that happened is that he tweeted one morning that he was going to take Tesla private, and that funding was secured. Funding clearly was not secured, as we now know, because he's reversed course. So the SEC is looking into it. It's possibly it was just Musk making a joke, Musk in an excitable mood, or Musk manipulating markets because he's angry at short sellers. And those things have very different consequences. So there is a lot of scrutiny of Tesla right now, a lot of scrutiny of Musk, and a lot of concern among shareholders and law enforcement officials. Something about the way the internet works and the way his fandom works and this kind of crushing adulation has made Musk a little bonkers. And so his board has asked him to get off Twitter and to start taking everything a little more seriously. He needs to settle down, run his companies, and keep his, you know, keep quiet for a little while.
So as you can hear there, celebrity comes with peril, and the law of unintended consequences weighs heavily on the superstar CEO, facing shareholders and employees. Joining the ranks of celebrity CEOs has gotten a lot easier, but staying in the good graces of a fickle public can be hard, even for the most charismatic chief executive. The best rule of thumb for ambitious leaders is to discover that fine line between celebrity and notoriety, and then work overtime to stay on the right side of that line. Former President Obama had a motto: don't do stupid stuff. And that is probably not a bad starting point for celebrity CEOs.
Yeah, I don't think Musk has been able to do that for a very long time. But I think it's not just the stupid stuff. I think of recent times, we've seen them doing rather, I guess you would say, dangerous things, like the likes of Zuckerberg and the likes of Sheryl Sandberg,
yes,
who play with our data, who mess around with our very notions of privacy.
So that is on an industry scale, but I'm thinking of a skincare company, The Ordinary, or Deciem, yeah, rather, and how there has been a bit of a shakeup because their CEO is fundamentally erratic on social media. It's not that he is necessarily making, you know, tremendous business decisions or, as you say, compromising privacy or doing anything illegal or even slightly illegal. It's more that he's using Instagram and Twitter as sort of a personal diary, and shareholders and customers, for that matter, watching this scenario play out on Instagram are a little bit shook and a little bit worried about the mental health, I suppose, of the person in charge of the company. And that's also not where you want a company to be. So it's an interesting point because I think this cult of celebrity cuts both ways. On the one hand, you want to know, who is this person? Who is Steve Jobs? What are their thoughts? How did they become so successful? And on the other hand, when you get a glimpse to the messy realities of whatever it is that they choose to show you on social media, they are maybe racist thoughts. There are all these things that go into it. Perhaps that makes people uncomfortable as well. So it's about oversharing as much as anything else.
I'm not sure if that applies, or rather if that's the same here, because if you look at entrepreneurs like Dato Sri Vida and Dato Alish Shukri, both who are in cosmetics and skincare, no matter what they do, their brand stays strong. And I think each time they do something or they stir up drama out of their own will, their sales seems to go up.
So I think I've mentioned before on this show also that I've been binge watching Shark Tank because it's available, right, on Netflix. And in so doing, I often wonder how the people who work for the sharks on the tank, basically the people in their companies who were there in their companies before these people started going on TV, started going on other reality shows connected to this, how do they feel? I mean, are they seeing somebody who they think is true to the boss that they're working for day to day? Or do they witness this person spouting off their business philosophies and think, well, that's not how you run the company. And I wonder whether there is that disconnect. Because for me personally, I think, and maybe it's because we are in a very flat organization and the people that we think of as our bosses or as management are actually very close to us in terms of hierarchy. Mm. And I wouldn't know what to think if they suddenly became an Elon Musk-style social media maven, going off and taking photos and writing long screeds on Twitter or Facebook. I think as somebody working for them, I would feel uncomfortable.
Well, I think it would be different if, let's say, if my boss was on Shark Tank, because for people who work in media, I think there is where we can distinguish between someone's actual personality and also their persona on air or on TV or on video. I think we always can make the distinction.
And what happens when there's a misstep, though? I mean, it's one thing to say that if everything's going well, but once there is a misstep, I think that changes things significantly. I mean, let us know what you think. Would you like to work for a celebrity CEO? Are you comfortable investing in companies with celebrity CEOs who may be, I suppose, writing books, giving TED Talks, but perhaps also behaving a bit erratically in the public eye? Let us know. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. Right now, we've got a track to take us to the news. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9, the business station.